We restart Quantum Gravity Seminars this week with a talk by Soin Pan that most of you know. She's a PhD student here at Perimeter. And today she will talk about Q-deformed loop quantum gravity with a cosmological constant. As usual, as you know, you can ask questions by raising your hand on Zoom, or you can ask anonymous questions using the usual Google form. Soin, feel free to start whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Alicia. Hi, everyone. I hope you had a great summer. So today, yes, I will talk about the cosmological constant in a framework of the LQG. So today we will focus on the 3D gravity, which is a simpler system than the physical one. And the cosmological constant is considered as ha to have different nature in different contexts. As in some field, it's considered as, for example, as a vacuum energy, and in some contexts, it's considered as a coupling constant, just like the Newton's constants. And this is the way we view it in this talk. And this is mainly motivated by a seminal work by Witten. So it's considered as a coupling constant in different approaches of quantum gravity, including the spin form and the transiment formulation, and also the loop quantum gravity. For example, in these approaches, it's interesting and consistent that when we consider the cosmological constant, they all realize a quantum group structure. For example, in the spin form model, including a cosmological constant would regularize the Poisson-Ritchie model to a theoretical model, and we view it as a model of gravity, including with a cosmological constant, by looking at the Semicircle limit of it, which gives the Ricci action with the lambda. But in this model, the quantum group is put by hand. So and from this approach, it's a bit hard to find where this quantum comes from. We have difficulty to search for the origin of it. And as a second model, the transiment formulation is to quantize the Foucaultian phase space given by a so-called classical R matrix, which we will also mention it later. Through a combinatorial quantization, and this would give us quantum group structure naturally if we accept the Poisson structure in the classical, then the quantization would give a quantum group in a very natural way. And also the benefits of using a transiment formulation is that we can write the 3D gravity in both Euclidean signature and a Lorentzian signature, and consider different signs of cosmological constant in a unified way. So it's like we can consider all the cases in a uniform way. But the drawback of this way of the transiment formulation is that it works only for 3D. So if we want to go beyond to 4D, the 3D gravity is not equivalent to a transiment theory. So even though we can learn a lot from this approach, it seems it doesn't give us a good guide for gravity in 4D. So we expect that the drawbacks from these approaches can be avoided if we consider the loop quantum gravity approach, because in LQG we directly start from the gravity. So just like inspired by the other two approaches, we can expect because in the other two approaches the quantum group actually deform the flat case means that the lambda is zero. It deforms the quantum groups deform the flat case by a parameter Q, which encodes cosmological constant and the quantum information. So even before we start constructing from the LQHT approach, what we can expect is that here we can also, the inclusion of the cosmological constant will also deform in some way our spin network states, which captures the quantum group structure. Okay, maybe we can go back way if we are expected to find some quantum group structure after we go through the construction of the loop quantum gravity. What we can get in the before we quantize it will be a classical version of the quantum group structure, which is the Poisson-Lee structure, at least at the discrete level. Okay, if we are supposed to find some Poisson-Lee structure in the discrete level before we discretize it, what we find would be a infinitesimal version of this structure, which is the Lie by algebra structure at the continuous theory. Otherwise, the Poisson-Lee structure comes from the discretization process. And this is what I want to describe in this talk. And I will go along the arrow direction, so from the right to the left. So I will start from an introduction, which is we will start from a 3D gravity with a lambda and see how we can get a deformed phase space from a discretization. Although it's an introduction, it's actually mostly based on some recent work by Maite, Florian, Lahore, and previous students, Majid and Julian. And then we will look into detail of this deformed phase space. First, in the kinematical level, we will look into both the holonomy flux phase space and also the spinners, the spinner representation. Then we look at the quantization of these classical objects, then to find the quantum holonomy and quantum flux, and also for the quantum spinners. And finally, we'll look at the dynamics of it. And in particular, we'll look into the Hamiltonian constraint in the spinner representation. So let's start the journey. So as it's a canonical approach, we first do a space-time splitting. Here we use the Euclidean signature for simplicity, and we can write the gravity action with a cosmological constant term in terms of the frame field and the connection. Here the Latin letters denotes the internal indices, and this wedge for forms on the space-time. To simplify the notation, we also take this constant to be one. So given this first order action, we can do a variation on the basic variables and find the equation motions. What we find are one gives the curvature and the other one gives the torsion-free condition. Then we find just from the equation motion, they generate the symmetry, which are namely translations and gauge transformation. What we find is that the gauge transformation is independent of the cosmological constant. So usually we impose the torsion-free condition, and then we describe the kinematical phase space, and then the first equation motion describes the dynamics of the system. So it was said that the quantum group structure should not appear in the kinematical level, but it's only appear when we impose the dynamics. So, but is it true? If we want to relate this this approach with, for example, the spin form, if we view a spin form at some path integral formula, then we should consider also off-shell configuration, then it's not natural that Y that the quorum group structures appear there. But here we should only find some quorum group structure if we impose dynamics. So can we do something else? Can we even find some source, some hint of quantum group structure, even in a kinematical level? This can be done by a canonical transformation. This is done in a work I mentioned. So the way to do it is to perform a canonical transformation, which is induced by a boundary term in this way. So this boundary term includes a constant vector n whose norm gives the cosmological constant. And here we also specify to the case when the cosmological constant is negative for some technical reason that I will mention later. And by performing this canonical transformation, we actually work with a new connection defined not just with the DSO connection, but also includes the frame field, and it's parameterized by this constant vector. With this new connection, we can solve again for the equation motion, and this new equation motion gives us the new notion of curvature and torsion. And yeah, as we wanted, the symmetries generated by these both depends on the cosmological constant. So this gives us the hope that we can, if we walk through properly the discretization quantization process, we can find a quantum group structure even from the kinematical level. Just to mention that to the change, the introduction of a new connection was also done by the work by Nui, Perez, and Danieli, but the connection we're considering here are not the same. And let's be even more explicit, since this n is a constant vector, but it was taken random before, but now let's take that it's pointing at the third direction. So this kappa is the square root of the cosmological constant. Just in case of some confusion, this kappa is not related to the kappa Minkowski or kappa Poincaré. So this kappa is just encodes the cosmological constant, and I insist to use this notation just to keep track of the literature about this work. So the relevant algebra of this symmetry turns out to be a bi-cross product of SU2 algebra and the AN2 algebra. So the brackets, the Lie brackets of this algebra written in terms of the generators of these two subalgebras look like this one. And this corresponds to a Iwasawa decomposition of the full algebra SL2C. So even just from looking at the Lie bracket structure of this, we find that because especially the cross term, we find that this is just constant the structure constant of the AN2 algebra, and this term is the structure constant for the SU2 algebra. So this, for those who are familiar with the Lie algebra structure, this is actually a Lie bracket of a double of SU2. So, and in this sense, we are viewing the AN2 Lie algebra as the dual of the SU2. And by dual, we mean that we have a bilinear map between the generators of these Lie algebra in this way. So working with the canonical transformation, we are actually dealing with a new symplectic form. So let's see what kind of phase space this symplectic form is describing in after the discretization process. By discretization, we means two things. The first one is the cell decomposition of this of the space. So the symplectic structure, the symplectic form would be subdivided into a sum of the symplectic form for each cell. And the second step is the symplectic form. What we find is that the symplectic form can be described by an AN2 group elements and an SU2 group elements. So at the end of the day, I didn't give many details of it. One can refer to this paper, or there's a talk by Florian in PI in 2020. So at the end of the day, we get a discrete phase space, which is described by the AN2 group and the SU2 group. And this corresponds to the Iwasawa decomposition of the SL2C. Why do we actually say that this discrete deformed phase space? By deform, we can recover the flat phase space, which is the Poincaré group, when we take the lambda equals zero limit. Great. So as the phase space in a mathematical language can be described by a Heisenberg double. And here, if we view the AN2 group as the dual of SU2, we say that it's a Heisenberg double of SU2. As a Heisenberg double, it also has the it's also associated with a bivector, which gives the Poisson brackets of any elements in the SL2C group. And this Poisson brackets is determined by a classical R matrix, which is an element in SL2C Lie algebra, tensor SL2C Lie algebra. So here the notation we use, the D1 is D cross identity and D2 is identity cross D. And if we write explicitly the R matrix in terms of the generators of the two subgroups, which is the generators of the two sub Lie algebras, which is AN2 Lie algebra and SU2, then we can write them in this way. Here, maybe I should change this. This is the AN2 SU2 generators, and this is the AN2 generators. Okay, this is one way to view the SL2C as the double. Another way is that it's also a double of AN2 if we view the SU2 as the dual of the as the dual group of the AN2. So in this sense, the SL2C is also a double of AN2. What it means here is that it corresponds to two unique Iwasawa decomposition of SL2C. Let's call one is left Iwasawa decomposition, and the other one is the right Iwasawa decomposition, which put respectively the AN2 element on the left or on the right. Great. And also we will mostly work on the fundamental representation of the AN2 and SU2 in a fundamental representation. The AN2 can be parametrized by a lower triangular matrix whose diagonal elements are a non-negative real element, and the off-diagonal element is a complex variable. So now that we can split an SL2C into a LU or U2L2 into an AN2 and SU2, we can also split the Poisson brackets for the full SL2C element into the Poisson brackets of this subgroup element. So what it means graphically is that we are thickening a link into a ribbon. So in each, so the in the four sides of this ribbon, we assigned a subgroup element for each side of this ribbon. And we view this ribbon as a deformed version of the our usual graph. Because if we take the flat limit, which the lambda equals zero limit, we have that the two holonomy would be the same. And it's like we are collapsing a ribbon into back to a link. And also these AN2 elements would be just the usual fluxes. And also we would recover the Poisson structure of the lambda zero limit. It's in this sense we would use the same terminology as the flat case, which is we would call it the U and U2 holonomies and the L and L2 fluxes, and just to correspond to the flat case. Okay, what we learn here. So we can ask what is deformed? What's very different from the non-deformed or the flat case? The difference is mainly that we have a back reaction of the flux on the holonomies. This doesn't happen in a flat case because of this semi-direct product. But here we not only have the holonomy action on the fluxes, we also have the flux reacting back to the holonomy. So this is one of the new features bring by this the deformed structure. Okay, that was for one link thickened to a ribbon. What about we consider a graph? Then for a graph, we can also do the same thing as for one link, we just thicken each link into a ribbon. Then what we have would be something like this if we are considering this graph. So we call this guy a ribbon graph. In this ribbon graph, we can find that the constraints can all represented by some closed of loops. For example, we have this ribbon constraint, which is just the equivalence of a left Iwasawa and the right Iwasawa, then it's described by a loop here. And the Gauss constraint is by a loop of the L's, and the flatness constraint is by a closed loop of a U's elements. And this is the exact form of for this graph, but it can be written in general if we're considering on other graphs. So the Gauss constraint can be written by a ordered product of more than three elements, and so as the flatness constraint. So, and if we look at the Gauss constraint and search for the geometrical interpretation, we find that if we parameterize the edge length with these L's, if we recover a hyperbolic cosine law, which means that the Gauss constraint is geometrically interpreted as a discrete hyperbolic geometry. What it means is that we know that globally we would have a curved geometry from the continuous sides. And how do we build this global curved? Are we just packing different flat pieces and just pack them in a curved case, or we are using the curved pieces to build a global curved geometry? Here, from the geometrical interpretation of the Gauss constraint, the building blocks of the global geometry are curved. Okay, let's give two more comments on these constraints. So we find that these constraints are all like have a holonomy natures because they can all written in terms into a close of loops. And also if we consider the symmetry, we find that the Gaussian strength generates the SU2 gauge transformation and the flatness constraint generates the deformed translation just like the flat case. So like this, the generators of the SU2 gauge transformation is written by the Gaussian strengths and the generators of the translations given by the flatness constraints. Okay, that was for the holonomy flux representation. Let's also work on the deformed spinners. But why do we care about spinners? There are different benefits, motivations for studying spinners. One is that we can work with canonical variables with a very simple Poisson structure, and its quantization will give us the harmonic oscillators, which is a good tool to study the construct coherent spin network states and coherent spinners, which is quite well developed in the LQG and the spin foam approaches. And it also can tell us about the UN, the UN symmetry, which is the algebra of the observables acting on the intertwined space. And these are the results of many works by many of the people here. And also studying the spinners will give us a different aspect of the discrete geometry. If we study the holonomies, then our center is on the links, and the quantization gives us a spin which geometrically represents the length of the link. But if we study the spinners, we shift our center to the vertices. And one of the work by Valentine and et al. to show that these spinners will capture or encode some information of, instead of a length, but some angles. But why do we want to deform spinners? Because as we said, the building blocks of the discrete geometry is curved. So using the normal spinners, it's not expected to give us some curved geometry. That's why we need to deform the spinners. Let's recall what is the spinners in loop chromatography language. It's given by a pair of complex variables. And it's dual, and this is the spinner, and this is, we call it dual spinner, dual in the sense that if we consider the brackets of these two spinners, they are kind of orthogonal to each other, and they are associated with a simple Poisson brackets. Using these spinners, we can recover the holonomy flux algebra if we define the fluxes by projecting this spinner onto a Pauli matrices and write the holonomy in this way. This holonomy flux algebra in the flat case can be fully recovered by this simple Poisson brackets. If we impose that the norm of these two spinners are the same. So graphically, we are associating a spinner to one half link of each link, and the other link is associated with another independent spinners. Okay, let's deform it. We first perform a kappa deformation. Again, let me remind you that this kappa is encoding the cosmological constant information. So we deform the spinner by multiplying a function which is a function of the norm, and then we would use these as the spinner variable to define a new spinner. And of course the Poisson brackets of these new spinners would also be different from the usual one. This these deformed spinners are useful because we can reconstruct the fluxes with these spinner variables. So we can define, if we are working on the phenomenal resolution, we can define the major segments as a function of these spinners in this exact way, and that we recover the Poisson brackets of those Ls. But the problem is these spinners are not SU2 covariant spinner. By SU2 covariant, we mean that they should transform in this in the infinitesimal level in this particular way. So here W is a SU2 infinitesimal element. So the action on a desired SU2 covariant spinner should transform in this way. Another problem of using this spinner is that if we just deform two spinners on each link, then we have two deformed spinners. But we have a ribbon graph now, but where there's an ambiguity where to place them in a ribbon graph. So for the first problem, we need to do another deformation. This deformation is just to find a solution to what is the SU2 covariant spinners. And we find that these are unique solutions. So the deformation from here is to times another function of the norm here. And okay, where to place them? So for sake of symmetry, we can first place them to an opposite corner of the of a ribbon, and we put them on a corner because they can be transformed by the SU2 holonomy if we do this. And what about the other two corners? We just learned that the Ls, the SAN2 elements, can be reconstructed by these spinners. So why don't we just use this AN2 element to parallel transport the spinners? And here is just a affected changed norm so that the resulting spinners have the same norm. How do we understand these tiles here? What kind of, are they spinners? What kind of spinner are they? To answer these questions, we just need to find what kind of transformation how they transform under the SU2 transformation. What we find is that perform the same transformation on these tau and tau tilde, we find that the result is parameterized by another SU2 elements, which is related. It's denoted by the W prime, but it's related to the original W by an SU2 action on the AN2 elements. So at the end of the day, we get four spinners in different sense on a ribbon. So what makes it very nice is that we can reconstruct holonomies with these four spinners in a very similar way as the flat case. So the U can be reconstructed by the spinner attached to two ends, so which is tau and T tilde. The U tilde can be reconstructed with the spinners attached to it, which is T and tau tilde. And we can check that with the simple Poisson structure of this deformed spinner, we do recover the flux holonomy Poisson structure. Also, from this ribbon picture, we find that the fluxes can also parallel transport the spinners, which didn't happen in a flat case. All right, if we have four spinners on one ribbon, what if we have a ribbon graph which contains more than one ribbon? Let's consider a node and its ribbon graph. And we find that depending on the orientation of the links, let's consider the E1 and E2 and just fix the orientation of E3. If we have four possibility of the pair of orientation, then it gives us four pairs of spinners. For example, if we change the orientation of E2 from outgoing to ingoing, we need to replace the tau and to tau tilt. And for each possibility, we also can choose, oh, whether we should use the spinner or the dual spinner. Then we also have four possibilities. Let's just denote them with some superscript. It's not straightforward to see that these objects are SU2 invariant because different spinner from different link, they transform differently. But we do find that by computing the Poisson brackets between this object and the SU2 transformation generators, they do Poisson commute. So these objects, the scalar product of these spinners are SU2 invariant. So that's the classical. We can see what happens in the quantization. The quantization, it includes mainly two steps. First is to quantize the flux and holonomies. Okay, we come back to the flux holonomies and then we will go to the spinner again. So we quantize the fluxes and holonomies into operators and also quantize the classical R matrix into some quantum R matrix whose classical limit, whose first H bar order give us back the R matrix we study in the classical. So if we consider the fundamental representation, the classical R matrix can be written into a 4x4 matrices. And its quantization will give us a quantum R matrix written in terms of a Q parameter, which includes the kappa, which is basically the cosmological constant, and the H bar, which is the quantum parameter. And using these two elements, we can quantize the Poisson brackets into commutation relations. For those who are familiar with quantum groups, they already noticed that this R is just a representation of the R matrix of the UQSU2. Then with this in mind, we can answer what quantum groups after quantization, what quantum groups are they? So the most obvious ones are from the U and U2. So these are just the defining commutation relations for the quantum group SU2, SUQ2, and SUQ inverse 2. The Q is for the tilt sector, and the Q inverse is for the non-tilt sector. And what about the L's? It's not the defining relation, but if we parameterize a UQSU2, UQSU2 into a 4x4 matrix operators, which is UQSU2, we have three generators, which is J plus, J minus, and K. So the K can be also written as the Q to the JZ over 2. With these commutation relations, then we put these generators into a matrix element of 2x2 matrices, then these commutation relations are nothing but these guys. So from these commutation relations, we find that, oh, the L tilt is the quantum group UQSU2, and the L is UQ inverse SU2. Now we learned that the quantization, the commutation relations just implies that the L and U are quantized to be UQ inverse SU2 and SUQ inverse 2, and the L2 and U2 are the same, but replacing the UQ inverse 2Q. And also, it's a well-known fact that the UQSU2 and SU2, they are dual to each other. By dual, it's in the sense of this divided map. So if we parameterize the UQSU2 in this form, then the duality is very neatly written in this way. So this is the fundamental representation of the quantum R matrix. So great, what we learned is that after quantization, we find both a Q and Q inverse deformation if we are considering the ribbon picture. Also, the duality between the holonomy flux actually extends from the classical to the quantum, but in different sense. In classical, it's the holonomy and flux, they are dual to each other in the language of Lie by algebra. And after quantization, they're still dual to each other, but in the language of the quantum groups. Let's look more detail of this computation relations of the quantum fluxes and holonomies. We can find that they are nothing but just the quantum Young-Baxter equations, that the quantum holonomy the quantum R matrix should satisfy. So this is the Young-Baxter equations for the quantum R matrix. If we restrict, so here the I, J are the indices for the first tensor elements, and the KL are the elements for the R2, for the second tensor elements in particular representation. So if we fix the second tensor part into a fundamental representation, then the K and L can only take these two indices, then we recover these computation relations. On the other hand, if we fix the first elements into a fundamental representation, we actually recover these computation relations. This is not something that very new in the quantum group. If we view these L and U as just some quantum groups, but now we are considering the holonomy and fluxes. This means that this quantum R matrix in these two, it actually contains both the flux and holonomy information. This gives a geometrical interpretation of this R matrix, which means that we can understand this R matrix as some quantum holonomies. And we expect that this way to understand the quantum R matrix can help us to gain more tools from the quantum group size to understand better the quantum gravity. As the last piece in this, in this quantum flux and holonomy subject, we can also quantize the Gauss constraint into a quantum Gauss constraint. It's just given by a co-product of the quantum fluxes, which is written in the standard way of the co-product of a quantum matrices. So, and after we quantize the Gauss constraint, we can find the solutions to this Gauss constraint, which gives the UQ-SU2 intertwiner. We will use this in when we consider the quantum spinners. Okay, which we consider now. So to quantize the spinner, it's very straightforward. It's just to quantize the deform spinners variables into a Q harmonic oscillators. So we quantize the holomorphic pieces into annihilation operators and the anti-holomorphic pieces to the creation operators, which obey the computation relation rule written here. So we can recover the usual computation relation rule of the usual harmonic oscillators if we take the Q equals one, which is the lambda equals zero cases. We can also recover the Jordan map from these harmonic oscillators to define the UQS2 generators. Here the J plus minus Z, by these computation relations, their computation relations of these three objects are the ones that the generators of UQSU2 should satisfy. Great, that is the most straightforward map. Okay, with this map, we can just directly quantize the spinners to a quantum one. And we call them quantum spinners, but in what sense? As a defining relation for a quantum spinner, they should satisfy by the generators acting on these quantum spinners to be determined in some way. So here, I just write in the operator into a dot, but we need to, and this, the definition of this dot will determine what kind of quantum spinners they are. What we find is that this T and T tilde, they are quantized to be the UQSU2 quantum spinners, but the T and tau and tau tilde, they are quantized to be the UQ inverse SU2 quantum spinners. By this, we mean that we fix the dot operators into a joint right action. Here, we say that it's UQSU2 because we use the joint right action of UQSU2. And here is the UQ inverse SU2 quantum spinners because we use a joint right action corresponding to these quantum groups. And with these, after we quantize these four quantum spinners, we can also reconstruct the quantum holonomy in also graphically very straightforward way. So we can define a quantum holonomy with the quantum spinners. If we look at the ribbon graph again, it's constructed by the tau and the T tilde. And the U2 is reconstructed by a T and tau tilde. You can check that they are indeed, one is in SUQ inverse 2, one is in SUQ 2. Not only that, we can also recover the whole combination relations between these quantum holonomy and these quantum holonomies and the quantum fluxes. So the full quantum structure is recovered by these quantum spinners. So with these quantum spinners, we can again consider a quantization of the scalar product of the spinners, which was given in this E notation. When we quantize these, we just consider to replace the classical spinners, the classical deformed spinners, to a quantum deformed spinners. What we find is that the scalar operators can be written into a tensor operators with the corresponding spinners in a very simple way, and we can prove that they are the UQSU2 integriner. They are UQSU2 invariants by checking its action on the integriner we found, and its action on the integriner gives us back the integriner with the coefficients proportional to a Q6J symbol. But this is not the standard way to define a scalar operator with spinners. The standard way to define scalar operators with spinners is in a braided way. So this braided is written with the R matrix. For example, if we consider the inner product, so the scalar operator of spinner from H1 and H2. So a standard way is to use the R matrix to braid if it's on a second link. It's used to braid this spinner from the second link in this way. But what's a bit surprising at the beginning is that this object, the standard way to define a scalar operator, is actually proportional to our scalar operators. Why is that? Why don't we need to use the braided structure here? The answer is that we are using a ribbon picture. In the ribbon picture, the quantum fluxes already plays the role of the braiding. This can be checked by multiplication of these quantum fluxes on the quantum spinners. So we have a very straightforward quantum version of the parallel transportation of the fluxes on the spinners. This means that if we are working on a ribbon picture, the braiding is actually a parallel transport. So if you think of a more general graph, if we are not considering two links, like one in one edge, one and two, if we have like two link one and another link that's more away from the first one, we need a lot of braiding. But here, if we are working on a if you are working on a ribbon picture, the scalar operators can be written in a very straightforward way. Okay, so as the very last piece, we consider the Hamiltonian with the spinners. So the Hamiltonian constraint or the finite constraint classically is written as a multiplication of the SU2 holonomies. When we are considering spinners, we can consider spinners, for example, in one corner and the other another corner, and the inner product, so all the scalar operators, the scalar product of these spinners can be viewed as, say, the holonomies transporting from one to another. Because of the flatness, these holonomies can be written by the rest of the loops. And also keeping in mind that the holonomies can be reconstructed with spinners, this Hamiltonian constraint can be written purely in terms of the scalar products of spinners. To quantize them is just to quantize these scalar, products into scalar operators to show that we are getting a correct quantum Hamiltonian is to find the solutions to this quantum Hamiltonian. We find that the solutions are the topological states. If we consider some Pacman moves of the states of the physical states, we find that the transition coefficients are given basically by the Q 6J symbol. We can consider the 3-1 Pacman move and the 2-2 Pacman moves. And if we consider the triangle faces in particular, we get a recurrence relations of the physical states by the minimal spin, which is 1/2. So this can relate this deformed LQG program to the spin form model. And the result in these pages is Q deformation of the well-known fact in the flat cases, when the flat cases is given by the Q equals 1. So that was what I want to talk about today. Let's summarize some lessons we learned. So firstly, we find that the quantum group structure can emerge from the continuous theory by performing a canonical transformation. We see the quantum group seeds from the continuous in the kinematical level. And the deformed spinners, we find that it shows up a ribbon structure. So in this ribbon structure, we are viewing the holonomy and fluxes in the same footings because they are both associated to some sides. So they both associate to some sides of ribbons, so they both have some holonomy nature. And also the constraints can be expressed in a very symmetric way. And in this framework, we are describing a global curved, global hyperbolic geometry from a discrete. So we are building the global hyperbolic geometry from curved building blocks. Also the quantization, would lead to a Q and Q inverse deformation, and a duality between the holonomy and fluxes inherits from the classical to the quantum. We also considered the spinners. The spinners, when we consider the deformation, they are deformed to capture the curved geometry, and the quantization also leads to Q and Q inverse deformation. And to connect with the spin form model, we constructed the deformed Hamiltonian, which has the topological solution and gives the recurrence relations of the Q 6J symbol. And we this can make it easier to connect to the Chern-Simons quantization because we use the very similar quantization, which is to quantize the Poisson-Lee structure to a quantum growth structure. So it makes it hopefully easier to connect it to the Chern-Simons framework. And to explore from this work, we can also consider the Euclidean case when we consider the positive cosmological constant. But in this case, what we need to study is not a half algebra, so not a quantum group, but a quasi quantum group. So in a classical, we need to not the Poisson-Lee structure, but the quasi Poisson-Lee structure. So more care should be taken in that side. And we can also consider to explore the Lorentzian signature in different signs of the cosmological constant. And we hope that this framework in 3D can shed some light in 4D and help us to find if we will have quantum group structure in 4D or not. And also we studied Q deformed spinners today. So we want to see if we can construct the Q deformed coherent states from these deformed spinners, which can deform the structure of the coherent state coherence in the twiness in the flat case. And as one of the last things to explore, I want to mention is that this different way of viewing the deformed phase space or the deformed elements may help us to understand the spinform model, not just by deforming the representations to Q deform representations, but we can study the spinform model from the first principle. And yes, that's it. Thank you.
Thanks, Irene, for this very nice talk. Okay, so let's start with the questions. And in particular, first, are there questions from students? For now, I do not see questions from students. Questions from anyone else? Okay, so while the others think about the possible question, I would start with one. So you gave a very detailed and somewhat technical talk, and I didn't really fully understand the motivations to develop this formalism. So can I ask you to summarize the goal of this series of work in non-technical terms?
Yes, so one of the motivation is to find that, to understand where the quantum group comes from the continuous. But this is okay. This is the motivation for the work I mentioned in the introduction. So we find that the quantum group structure can emerge from the continuous if we perform a canonical transformations. So now we just want to see what kind of in the discrete classical discrete level, what structure it is. That's what gives us the quantum groups. And after we quantize it, what kind of quantum groups we find? What is the structure?
And how difficult will it be, in your opinion, to generalize to the case of four dimensions?
four dimensions. If we want to follow the same storyline, maybe we can also start from the continuous. But I think there's already a question that whether we would have a quantum groups in 4D. Or we can start if we assume that there should be a quantum groups. We can also do an inverse direction. If we say we want quantum group structure in the quantum level, what would be the structure, explicitly the Poisson-Lee structure in the classical, but at least in the discrete level?
Okay, thanks. I see a question from Andrew.
Yep, thank you for the interesting talk. Yeah, as Alicia said, it's quite technical, so some of the calculations is sort of, so the big picture I got from basically what you're doing, you're in 3D, right? This is a 3D computation, and what you're doing is you're starting from the Poisson-Lee group, basically the double of SU2 or the double of whatever the algebra, and then you discretize and then integrate into the double of, you know, the group SU2. But my question is, as far as I understand, you can understand the double of a group as a trivial cross module. Trivial isn't like the T-map is the identity. So, and cross modules are two groups. So when you deform, right, when you you use like the usual procedure to deform the double to like U of Q or whatever, when you do that, like what kind of, at least in the cross module language, do you know how to do you know what that does? Like, is that a functor? Is that something like, what does it do?
Are you considering the 4D? Because you want
no, to just in 3D. Yeah, because I have something to say about 4D as well. But if we understand how this deformation works, at least in the context of like using categorical language, right, to describe, maybe there's a, well, not functor, sorry, maybe that's the wrong word, because procedure, let's say. I'm just curious, like what, like the, how, yeah. No, sorry, maybe my question doesn't make any sense, because it's starting to not make any sense to me. Okay, maybe I'll put it this way. So consider, let's say I have like a collection of cross modules or two groups, whatever, you know, groupoid objects in the category of groupoids, and then I classify them, for example, up to homotopy or up to equivalence or something like this. So if you perform, and we know that the Drenfeld double is, you know, the trivial, it's in the trivial class. So if we deform it, can it become non-trivial? Can it become, can it leave the trivial class, essentially?
What is the definition for this trivial class?
So, okay, so this goes into like the group cohomology. If you compute the, if you interpret the two group, right, as a four-term exact sequence, then that exact sequence is classified by degree three cohomology class. And if that class is trivial, then, you know, we say that the two group is trivial, essentially. And of course, if you have like, you know, you have the T map in the middle, right? And you have kernel and co-kernel on either side. So of course, if T is the identity, you, like all these things are zero, are like one, right? So you have nothing there. So there's no way you can get a non-trivial class or cocycle anyway, because everything's just trivial. But and that's the case for the Drinfeld double of a group. So in 4D, right, what Florian and I are thinking about is that we actually start with a non-trivial two group, because the rationale is that essentially particle-like, point-like defects, and you can have point-like defects and string-like defects in 4D, and you can fuse them, you can braid them, you can do all kinds of stuff, and you need 4D for that to happen. But then once you have those structures, you can, you know, for example, use a regular one group to source your point-like defect. You use the G. I'm trying to think of a way to sort of not use too much terminology, but you use the target group to source the string-like defects, and then you use the source group of the two group to source the point-like defects. And essentially, you label charges of the point-like defects with, like, it's coming from this non-trivial degree three cohomology class, essentially. So without that, you essentially don't have any point-like defects. So what we're thinking is that if you want to study, like, in a very general sense, like 4D, what happens in 4D, essentially, then you have to think about, like, actual non-trivial groupoids. For example, a two group, and then you have all this categorical structure, and then you take the double. I think people have done that, actually. Like, there's some work that's been done to sort of understand the categorical structure of a double of a groupoid, essentially. But then the problem is, like, you know, how do we deform these things? And I don't think there's a answer to this yet. I don't think, right? So, like, in 4D, I think
maybe this can provide one direction to go beyond from 3D to 4D, which partially answer Alicia's questions. But from my perspective, I don't know. I don't really answer.
Right. It's just that in 3D, like, yeah. Sorry, maybe the question wasn't very well thought out. But yeah, thanks.
Okay, we have time maybe for one more question, if anyone wants to ask.
Chaoyun, I've asked Laurent and Florian and Maite all this question, so if you can't answer it, it's not your fault. I still don't understand it. When you went back to when you were working in the continuum theory and you did the canonical transformation, you had to select this vector n in the boundary, right? And I find that vector n very surprising. It seems like it should break the symmetry at some level, but somehow it exposes the quantum group symmetry in a deep way. And I still don't feel like I understand that juxtaposition of ideas. So I was wondering if you have a deeper understanding into the breaking of the symmetry, but allowing the quantum group symmetry through this n vector. Is it clear what I'm asking?
I don't think it's, we should think of it as a breaking of the symmetry, but we are looking at a symmetry in a different aspect. So if we look at the algebra, the full algebra, here is the SL2C, we are like doing a different, we are considering a different basis, which corresponds to the USO decomposition of the SL2C.
But
so I would not say that you are breaking symmetry.
Yeah, but the selection of a direction for n is what concerns me. I can state it simply, you know, at the level of SU2Q, you do the same thing. You pick one generator to be different from the others, the Z generator usually. And that's strange, right? Like the symmetry that this group is supposed to implement should still have sort of a rotational symmetry, but you've also selected out a direction. And that's what I'd like to have a deeper understanding of.
The introduction of the vector is considered as a constant vector, so the variation is zero. So I don't see that we still also need the rotation symmetry for this, and we are taking this as a constant, but correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, Rahul or Florian can correct me.
The N is precisely picking up this direction you mentioned for the quantum group. So the direction 3 is picked. That's exactly what the N does. N is picking the direction 3. And you are adapting your symmetries, you're deforming your symmetries to incorporate this preferred vector so that the symmetries are depending on the vector. And so you still have symmetries even though you have a preferred direction. But as you said, in the quantum group, you have a preferred direction, and that's exactly this N.
And but Florian, what is the physical meaning of that preferred direction? How should I understand what that represents physically?
Physically?
Because I agree with you completely. The mathematics is clear.
It's not a preferred direction. It's just a choice because you can still rotate everything around.
So physically, I'm not too sure what the... it works perfectly well, the physics.
In other words, in these geometries, what's special about the Z direction? So I agree with you, Bianca, it's just a choice of one of the generators, but like, why should we pick out that generator?
Maybe it's to be able to discretize. So if you want to discretize the theory, you need to have things which are valued in a group. And so, for example, if you work only with boost, boosts are not forming a group. So if the frame field is valued in the group, then you cannot discretize the theory. It is valued in the boost, then you cannot discretize the theory. So you need to break up. You need to find a new Lie algebra such that you get a Lie algebra so that you can discretize it. So maybe, I don't know about physics, but so it's not really math there, but maybe a bit of physics. So it's the N provides you a way to discretize.
Thanks, everybody.
Okay, so I think it is a good point to close the discussion. And I would like to ask everyone to unmute yourself to thank again, Shawin, for the nice talk and discussion.
Thank you.